This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hi there. My name is Anne Gosler, the student editor on the podcast, and this episode is our 100th. We're delighted that we have reached this landmark and thank all our listeners and contributors since we started the Urban Political in 2019. To mark the occasion of this 100th podcast, we have produced a special issue containing two parts in which we look backwards and forwards on all things urban and political. In the first part, Marcus Kipp and Ross Beveridge talk to Mathilde Gustafsson about the origins of the podcast, why they set up the podcast and how things have changed since the beginning, and also what their favorite podcast episodes were. In the second part of the episode, Ross, Marcus and Nitin Butler talk to four of our most regular and brilliant guests, Roger Kyle, Colin McFarlane, Julianne Boudreau, and Urban Political Collective member Hannah Hilbrand. We ask them to look back 6 years to 2019 and consider what has changed in the urban political landscape, what urban research and practice needs to do to grasp the contemporary moment. Finally, our third question is asking what they think in reality might change in the coming years. Now, thanks for your support as a listener and enjoy the episode.
I'm Mathilde Gustafsson, one of the editors of the podcast, and today I'm joined by our two co-founders, Ross Beveridge and Marcus Kipp, to celebrate our 100th episode. Thank you both for being here. Tell our listeners why you originally decided to start the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Mathilde and Ross. Well, I remember in 2019, Ross coming up with the idea, having commuted from home to the office, that it would be great to have a podcast that basically provides summaries of new articles and new points of discussion in urban studies to listen to while being on the train. And I think we picked up that idea from there. It was, for at least for me, in 2019, listening to podcasts was a new thing, and I got really hooked on some shows and was very excited about putting that idea into practice.
I do remember the origin story was sadly in the kitchen of the Georg Simmel Centrum in Berlin. We were just starting to listen to podcasts and thinking that there weren't any, or there certainly weren't many, in the field of social science generally, and certainly in urban studies. So and just a kind of idea, and then Marcus basically totally went with it and kept pushing it every now and then, and it became more and more concrete, I suppose. And it just kind of, I think it took quite a long time to get up and running. We didn't know anything, of course. We didn't know how to, how you edit, you know, how you record, what platforms you use, and basically Marcus did a huge amount of heavy lifting there, and got us into the situation where we recorded a podcast, still one of my favorite podcasts, the one on Checkpoint Charlie. We'll talk about that later, perhaps. But yeah, and then I think that was the kind of idea that, you know, the podcast were maybe a different way of a lighter way of or just an alternative to reading, or just getting an insight in a different context, you know, like when you're on train or commute or something like that. Yeah,
and I guess also to spark a bit a debate within the field, no, and also have this, now that's why we called it an podcast on urban theory, research and activism, to create some sort of easy access to a common debate, space of debate across those three fields. At least that was the hope, no? Having been slightly disillusioned with the conference debates and the kind of conference venues as the only real life space for debates.
Yeah, I do think that was another intention we had once we started a bit more organized, that we wanted to, and I think we have more or less generally over the years tried to make the podcast accessible to a large community of scholars. I think being less successful in integrating or reaching out to activists, practitioners, but certainly in terms of providing this platform for scholars to basically have their voice, you know, to talk about stuff. So, you know, if you don't have to go to a conference necessarily to get people to listen to the work you're doing, or you don't have to get paper accepted necessarily. Certainly that was another thing we wanted to do. And I do think we have provided kind of opportunities for people to have their kind of role in that urban studies, urban research community.
And so in the beginning, it was really just the two of you working on the podcast, and the format was maybe a little different than what we tend to publish now. Can you tell us how the podcast has changed over the years?
I think we experimented with a lot of formats in the first few years, seeing what was possible, what was also most fun. And I always refer to our approach as punk rock, in the sense of just trying it out without having much of expertise on it. And you can see in the first year or two that there was not really a clear strategy behind producing episodes or creating some sort of coherent narratives or shows. That certainly has become more formalized, more strategic, and now with the collective running the podcast, it has also become more deliberate and more thought through.
I would agree that do-it-yourself attitude, the punk attitude, was very important, and it did. You know, some of those early podcasts, there's some pretty punk production values in some of the recordings. You know, we were doing it by ourselves, and you know, now we have different quotas. We you know, we have support, and we're very grateful to have support from the Georg Simmel Center at the Humboldt University that provides us with our editorial assistant, Anna. Does a great job, and I get a bit of time from urban studies, social policy at University of Glasgow, so we have a little bit more stability. But it is really hard to keep podcasts coming out. If you look at a lot of podcasts, they tend not, it's quite hard, unless you've got big institutional kind of backing, to just keep going. And I think that's one of the great things about having the collective. You know, we've had some very active members like yourself, Matilda. You know, we've also kind of led on this, and Nitin as well, of course, Nitin Batla, and Hannah Hilbrandt, and many other people who've helped us make podcasts and produce podcasts. And that's one of the big changes from that first year, where it was just Marcus and I.
Well, and if we zoom out a little bit, maybe it would be interesting to talk about how the podcast landscape has changed since 2019, and perhaps especially the academic podcast landscape.
I think now there are many podcasts. You'd certainly see that. There are lots of academic institutions that have podcasts. Lots of journals have podcasts. And there are also lots of in the urban studies community. Urban Studies Journal has a really nice podcast. Sheffield, University of Sheffield, the Urban Institute, they have a really nice podcast as well, to name just two. So you have more, I wouldn't say necessarily competition, but you know, you have more reference points, and there's like a landscape there. So that creates a different, you're aware of what other people are doing. So that kind of feeds in a little bit to what you're doing. Although I would say the main thing the main challenge is to keep producing on a monthly basis. I think that's just really, really hard. And we try to be a bit more reliable than we were in the past. I think people listen to podcasts differently now. You know, we have a sense that, you know, there was a big surge in people listening to podcasts. You know, 2019 through the pandemic, lots of people were listening to podcasts. And now there's a huge industry of podcasting. You know, it's much more commercial, and maybe more people listen to these big, highly produced podcasts. You know, lots of famous people doing podcasts. You know, I don't know if it's just like it's the podcasting world feels a bit different to now to the 2019 situation. Not that it was just loads of little punk operations like us. It wasn't like that necessarily, but it did feel different in terms of the way in which people engaged with it. So there is a question also, I suppose, whether, you know, Twitter not being there, we were quite integrated that more progressive Twitter era. It has its own problems, of course, but that really, it was a networking. It did function as a network in a kind of chaotic and also often problematic way, but it did connect you to people, and it's hard to find a substitute for that, I think. So I wonder how much that's affecting podcasting, and you know, now things seem to go through platforms much more, you know. So, you know, the platforms advertise podcasts, and it becomes more and more standardized, you know, what's Apple recommending to you or Spotify, and which happens in loads of sectors, but I think for smaller podcasts like ours, that's really, really a big challenge.
As a podcast consumer, I mean, there are so many podcasts that I really enjoy listening to, and it's just there are just not enough hours in the day to listen to all of them, to follow all of them. And I think this whole growing diversity and offer of podcasts pushes podcasts to occupy a particular niche or one very particular to create a really clear profile, so you can communicate to the audience what distinguishes you from others, and then the audience can make a decision whether to follow you or not. And I think we were at in the early stages, we felt, I don't know if we actually were, but it felt like, oh, we are relatively free to just go with whatever topics and formats we are interested in doing and what produces most fun. And I think that that approach probably does not work in a similar way anymore, even though I still think that having fun producing podcasts is the prime or should be, at least for me, the prime motivator.
It just, I would also say, just when we started, we certainly felt we were doing something quite novel in the urban research community, at least. You know, we were one of the only you know, podcast doing that. And now, of course, you know, there are lots, and we're not original, and, you know, lots of people are doing it. And podcasts are, you know, is the medium, that method is so common now. You know, it's really common to even teaching. You know, students are often asked to do podcasts now as part of, you know, assessments and things, which is a great idea. So it does mean that, I think, when people listen to the podcast, they probably have different expectations. I think, you know, maybe 2019, when, you know, there was loads of background noise and beeping noises in the recording, and, you know, if things were a little bit wobbly on the Zoom contact or something, people would have just brushed it off. Or whereas now, I think, you know, there's probably an expectation that, you know, this podcast should be produced to a certain level, and there shouldn't be too many ums and ahs and those kind of things. So, so in that sense, I suppose there is that sort of professionalization, and the expectation from the listener, I think, is probably quite different to the way it was in 2019, 2020.
Well, so now that we have 100 episodes of The Urban Political, I'm curious to hear what some of your favorite episodes are.
Yeah, that's a tough question, because I honestly enjoyed producing virtually all of them. But I think I'd like to highlight those episodes that had a direct connection to current events, to current struggles, like we had with conversations with activists and researchers in Hong Kong during protests, in Berlin during the housing referendum, in Chile, in Ukraine, in Spain, and even an episode produced by activists in Iran. We had voices from exiled Russian activists and people in Israel and Palestine during the Gaza war, insights from corona lockdowns in Mexico, Kenya, Algeria, Lebanon. I think those were, for me, the most inspiring ones because they provided direct and unfiltered insights and in that sense were eye-opening for me to kind of develop my own judgment about current situation that is happening. I'd like to just like these kind of podcasts in the news categories that I particularly enjoyed or really struck me as important when producing them. But I was also very fond when the first episodes produced by other folks from joining the collective were coming out. They had a different flavor and they really expanded the spectrum of what the podcast could possibly be. And I think those were among my highlights.
I had those on my list as well. I think the ones that really seemed to capture or engage with something live or something that was still really present, and particularly the one for the scholars in Iran was a really kind of brave one as well. You know, the kind of given all the problems and difficulties of doing that kind of thing and making a voice, taking a stand on those things in an anonymized way, but still really fascinating. And as Marcus said, the collective, people like Mais and Leah and Nitin and Hannah have all done great podcasts. And I remember when that started happening, we were really happy, not just because it took a burden off us, but just because it was a nice growing of the family. And you as well, Matilda, you know, you've made a number of podcasts, great ones too, the rental struggles and stuff. But I would say, as I suggested earlier, that somehow I have a soft spot for the Checkpoint Charlie one, because that's right at the beginning, and it was a double header, and it was actually made it was more like a radio documentary. It was a huge amount of work. Again, it was Marcus who took lots of heavy lifting, cycling around Berlin, interviewing loads of people. It was a bit like his old BBC documentary or something. The kind of resources that just aren't sustainable for a podcast. People, you know, we're not getting paid to do that. It took ages. We were in the studio as well. And I remember this sort of tech, you know, the tech guy, the studio guy getting really grumpy because we weren't speaking into the mics properly and all this kind of stuff. So, and it's actually a really good podcast, even if you're not so interested in the Checkpoint Charlie case. It's really interesting exploration of the city of Berlin and the developments around that part of the center of Berlin. So always I have a kind of soft spot, and I did listen to a little bit of it. It seems like a long time ago now, but it's very different to all the other podcasts. But I'd say still in my top 10.
Yeah, true, for me as well. Yeah, that was certainly it was fun producing it, and also not sustainable. I mean, if we had continued to put that amount of work into podcasts, we probably would be at episode number 10 now or something.
Exactly. And we should, yeah, we would have been lucky if we made 10. And we took, we should also thank all the guests on that one, but particularly Christoph Sommer, our old friend and colleague there, who gave up quite a lot of his time to be interviewed for that, which I don't think many people would be able to do on a regular basis. Yeah, so what about you, Matilda?
Well, I would say I think of the more recent podcast. I think that the episode on spatial planning in Israel Palestine, and the Gaza War that you hosted, Marcus, with Mice was really great. I really like the recent mini series that we did on urban polycrisis, focusing on different geographic contexts. I think it's really great. And then I like the episode that you did recently, Ross, on digital cities and democracy. That was sort of this book review format, but multiple books being put into dialogue with each other. A really nice format, to do these book review podcasts that we tend to do. Yeah, but I need to go back and listen to this Checkpoint Charlie podcast. I don't think I listened to that episode. So, as a final question, how do you think theory, research, and activism has changed over the years and affected how we talk about the urban on the podcast?
It's a tricky one. I think that obviously the whole political situation is feels very different. Well, in 2019, it wasn't like everything was fantastic or anything. It was already, I suppose, in some kind of sense of uncertainty, general uncertainty. But now the extent of that feeling of anxiety or uncertainty and this crisis feeling and crisis talk, this much stronger. And so that I suppose that changes or is changing agendas for researchers in not just in urban studies but also in urban studies. So more people are rightfully concerned about authoritarianism, and we have 3 podcasts coming up on authoritarianism before Christmas, I think. So the topics are changing, and I suppose you is there also a feeling, I don't know, that you might be questioning how useful it is to be a researcher. I suppose, and research itself is also under stress, you know, real stress in lots of places, universities, and it's under stress. And you know, you combine that with the way that there's a clampdown with on activism in lots of countries, and really clear moves towards authoritarianism, fascism. We have to say, not only in the US, also in other places. If the topics are changing and there's an uncertainty about the usefulness of it, it is affecting the kind of podcasts that we're making. We are making these podcasts on crisis and things, and we are be a bit more reflexive about what we can do. And it must filter into the uncertainty we have about how we can get out of this situation, what it is we could do to get out of it. Perhaps they're alongside this idea, perhaps that, you know, the urban isn't as high on the agenda. You know, this big urban age discourse moment seems to have resided a bit, and you know, people are talking about return of nationalism and nativism and things. I'm not I'm sure I totally think it's a return to the nation state, but there are definite returns to nativism. I suppose everything seems to be churning all the time, much faster as well. So it creates a lot of challenges, and it's hard to know how to grasp that. So I suppose, so in terms of making the podcast, we have responded. So we were doing different podcasts, and we're trying to create this series around crisis, maybe a series on authoritarianism. Who knows how that will. How things will change into next year. I mean, no doubt we will focus even more on those kind of things. And that's what, but I think it's important that we hold to different experiences, global experiences. Another thing we've tried to do, not always successfully, but I think quite successfully, is to have a quite global perspective, so to have different perspectives from different parts of the world, from different positions and different subjectivities, and I suppose to not always feel overwhelmed by this dominant discourse of crisis and things, which is kind of very connected, I think, of course, to the global north, when, you know, people in the global south have been living crisis conditions, many do, for as a kind of state of normal. So like everyone else, we're responding to it, and it's happening quite fast. I'm starting to repeat myself now, so I'll hand over to Marcus. Say something intelligent.
Okay. Well, I think when starting the podcast, I mean, we were still on, like, I still am, but like, we were very strongly influenced by this kind of progressive promise of the urban, like, and of urban democracy as in, what's the proper word, like an insurgent tendency within a globalizing world that creates new opportunities and possibilities, and that are important to, like, turn into an emancipatory fashion. In 2019, I know we were also both very inspired by the experiences in radical municipalism, no? And we had a couple of episodes on that, and they generated a lot of hope. And I think that, yeah, that has also come to a point where it's now necessary to reflect on the latest wave on municipalist experiences and how far they have gotten, and what to learn from these experiences to start it in a new fashion once the opportunity arises. And I think right now there is, at least in my estimation, there's not something similar on the horizon. I mean, we are in a position to defend things that we took for granted, like the rule of law, that we defend certain principles of liberal democracy, and to be anti-fascist, and like things that that just to hold the space that we are, but there's clearly a difficulty to foresee an alternative future. And I'm curious about hearing more of those alternative visions. I recently came across the Zone à défendre, the French Zadism. I'm not entirely sure yet that is really the new hope for radical urban left, but that I think is one of the biggest challenges that distinguishes our moment from the moment 6 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's really true, and this really captures it in a nutshell. And that move from this hope, the hope of the city, to this kind of the moment where we are now, where there seems to be no kind of there are no projects from which you can gain that hope. There doesn't seem to be a coherent movement. There's no new municipalist. There's no radical municipalist movement. And I suppose then the trick is to somehow maintain a researchable, you know, the move to authoritarianism, fascism, the resistance to that, and at the same time somehow detect new kind of, whether it's movements or ways of thinking, theoretical innovations or connections between places, so that you know, you can start seeing how there might be a way to navigate out of it. Of course, we can only play a modest role in our podcast, but that's quite different to 2019, where, you know, we had those series on new municipalism, and we had it with Matt Thompson and Bertie Russell, Laura Roth, and but a great one also looking back on Latin America with Gianpaolo Baiocchi as well. You know, so you had a sense of this, everything was connected and there was still stuff happening, and now it feels like there's a real jish, you know, it's like a disconnect there in a way, or there's the churning of this moment.
I mean, what do you have in store for the next 100 episodes?
Okay, right. Everyone has to have a go. I'll go first. But so I think the next 100 episodes we will be having many more podcasts about this dialectical moment that we're in between fascism and the struggle with that, and this feeling between this sort of chasm between kind of hope, I suppose, and the disillusionment around us. I think we should be exploring the how that works dialectically. And beyond that, I mean, if we make another 100 podcasts, I think that would be pretty. Another 5 years of making podcasts will be, who knows where we'll be, you know, hopefully in a better place.
I totally agree with you, Ross. I think it would be great to also have the podcast as a space for nourishing or for cultivating hope, and to bring this into a conversation about how that hope that still keeps on pushing people forward can also be operationalized into some sort of collective strategy. What we can learn from different places in terms of tactics and share those kinds of experiences, and especially like to also hold this podcast as a space of the urban that doesn't cave into the trend to close down on the nation state, or like to become a closed space, but to keep it open also on a very like deliberately global level, always seeking to expand this network. And I think that would be a really valuable conversation for the next episodes to come.
I think that's great. I think I was going to say something similar, is to try to use the podcast to feature specific struggles to create or facilitate this sort of knowledge sharing at a tactical and strategic, at a really practical level between activists and organizers in different cities or different scales even. I think that becomes even more important in this current political moment than it already was.
After this first part with the founders of the Urban Political, we're now transitioning to the second part of the episode, for which we invited a few of our most regular guests. Listen to how they are looking back and forward with their experiences in the field.
To start off, we want to look back. Later, we want to look forward in this podcast. I wanted to ask you what you thought would be the most important changes in urban theory, research and activism since 2019, since we started making the podcasts, and how that has changed or not, the way in which we think, write and act in relation to the urban and the political. And then I suppose related to that, how your own research might have also changed in this period. So to start us off, Julianne, would you like to have a go as addressing that question?
I remember I first recorded a podcast with you during the pandemic. I was very worried back then because it was about my book, Global Urban Politics. And in that book, I talk about the strength of the urban political in relationship to the national state. And of course, during the pandemic, well, the state came back like full force, right, to regulate and govern whatever the crisis. So since the pandemic, the strength of the national state in urban politics has been increasing more and more. And we have seen that quite a lot, whereas before 2019, we were, well, at least in my case, I was able to do a lot of urban research without bothering too much about the national state. And this has become so strong right now with the turn to the extreme right and the seize of power by right wing politics at the national level. And this, of course, changes quite a lot how we can think about the urban political.
From here, Roshi, would you like to come in and take up where Julianne left off? What's changed since 2019?
Well, I'm convinced that Julianne is right about this. I just hadn't posed that question for myself in quite the same way, because I live in a country where the state is always there, and the government, and particularly compared to the neighbor south of us, where we talk differently about the state. We talk differently about the state at all scales and levels, and the city is always sort of, as it's called, a creature of the province. It's not, you know, city politics, urban politics. It's always seen in relationship to the state. But of course, during the pandemic, but also in through other influences, the climate crisis and anything else that has been thrown at us over the mobilization for war, which is now very strong in all nation states, those kinds of things have brought the state back in that sense, in that classical sense of it. But I thought during those years since 2019 that there was a strange new dialectics also between globalization and deglobalization. There was a globalization of theory in urban studies, a true globalization, not just talking about the global in urban studies, but global urban studies now and urban theory is a global event. And this is not, never will we go back beyond that. When I started thinking about urban studies, it was all North America and Europe, and urban theory was, North America and Europe. And then many different types of globalization efforts have been made. And I call it now globalization because there are other terms now. When I started, we talked about internationalization. Now globalization has been sort of pushed to the side. Planetary is one of the terms. But over the last 10 years or so, what we do and how we think, in particularly think, has become a global affair. But that has been countered by deglobalization, as we have recently seen over the last year or so, with the new attempts to create borders through tariffs and, of course, also in terms of the regulation of migration worldwide. And of course, also the closing of the borders as a real experience for everybody in the world through the COVID crisis. So we have seen what that does to the world, and what is surprising perhaps is, to some degree, how the people who are controlling it, or the factions of capital, or the people around the world who control this deglobalization process, are not necessarily urban elites, but they tend to be a new breed of populist politicians whose politics is not urban by definition, but it's often anti-urban. So that's one theme, perhaps. I have some other ideas about what happened in the last 6 years, but I just wanted to riff a little bit on Julianne's astute observation.
Thanks, Roger. Hannah, what would you say have been the main transformations in the last 5 years, feeding into what Julianne Roger have already mentioned?
Yeah, thanks. These are good questions. I felt it was a good occasion to go back these 6 years and scroll a bit through the many, many podcasts that have been done. Because also 6 years ago feels like almost a different era. Now I think it's nice to come together and have this moment to really look back and recap and pause on all the things that have happened. You know, if you're thinking about energy and geopolitical changes, the pandemic, of course, the rise of AI we haven't mentioned yet, no, all the things we've discussed already in relation to the state, but also climate questions, no, the intensifying of wildfires. And then, of course, you've got all like war issues coming into the picture. Of course, already 14 with Ukraine, but then a much more intensified version in 22. Now, today, if we're thinking about, of course, war, we're thinking about Al-Fashir or Gaza, no, like all of these politics weren't politics we were thinking about in terms of urban politics before as well. No, and I think when I thought back, I was reflecting a bit about how these sort of issues we would have maybe previously not discussed as urban topics have entered the urban, no, in terms of, for instance, herbicide. I'm thinking also in terms of housing politics being domesticated by the far right, no, these national politics moving into the city. If we're thinking, for instance, in terms of Trump's warfare towards certain cities, all of these like national or global changes are suddenly bringing new topics into the urban realm that also require us to think differently about the urban, to theorize differently. I guess we're going to talk about this a bit later as well.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah. Colin?
Yeah, thanks, Ross. I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what is being said, about all of what is being said by everyone else so far. I think there's been a kind of, it feels like COVID-19, 2020, there was this moment of arrival of obviously a profound crisis on different scales. And I think that sense of crisis has remained with us and deepened. And of course, it's not a singular crisis. It is, as you've been exploring on the podcast and in other ways, a polycrisis and converging around, you know, everything that people have mentioned: climate change, authoritarianism, I kind of curiously often anti-urban authoritarianism, and it's coupling with sort of neoliberalism and populism, you know, in the ways that have been described. And I think that sense of crisis has now seeped into how we think the urban, or how many of us think about the urban. And of course, it's very unequally lived, that sense of crisis, but there's become a sense in which knowing the urban has also become caught up with knowing crises of different kinds. And so what that does to how we think about the urban, how we conceive it, I think is an interesting question. What it does to how we think about possibility, the potential for change, I think that's an interesting question, because there is always this risk with crisis thinking that you can erode or overwrite or colonize your sense of the possible. Whereas meanwhile, the political right has a very active sense of the possible. The left feels kind of exhausted in some ways in that respect. So there's like a bunch of questions, I think, around crisis that are stuff in the back of my mind that I think have become more profound for how we think about and act in the urban and what that means for the urban political. And then the other thing, last thing I would say, is that there seems, I think there's maybe a related sense in which some of the terms that we use, you know, the urban, urbanism, city, the global, the urban political, are kind of up for grabs. And of course, they always have been to some extent populated and repopulated as concepts, as ideas, as processes, you know, conceptually and materially. But I also feel that at the moment there's a real kind of radical uncertainty about what we mean by these terms. Not to say there should be a consensus around them necessarily, that has been engendered partly by the conditions we find ourselves in, post-COVID and a misphased crises. I mean, what does it mean, for example, to talk about urbanism in the context of something like Palestine, where you're seeing, you know, destruction on levels that we've not seen for generations? And then also, I think in the wake of the debates on planetary urbanization and so on, I teach a module at the moment called Global Urbanism to my Level 3 students. And one of the things that they keep saying is exactly this, that it feels like these towns are up for grabs. Like, you know, how do we think about the urban? How do we think about the urban political? There's a kind of, and they can feel both energized by that and also to some extent destabilized by it, this sense that there's an uncertainty epistemologically and materially around what these things are, these basic building blocks of how we think about the urban. So I'll leave it there, but those are two thoughts, I think, just connecting a little bit to what colleagues have said.
I feel this is a really important point also if we're talking about populism in the far right. I find myself lately reading a lot of like abstracts or pamphlets that use the exact same vocabulary that we are using in critical urban studies, which is also like increasing the sense of uncertainty about what things mean for different people. You can read about questions of justice and home and the politics of feminism, and what's behind it is actually really far-right thinking. I think this appropriation of our critical terms is also challenging, Colin. I think you mentioned this really well, that we are facing.
Roger, would you like to come in?
Yeah, just quickly, because I also have thought about language concepts and so on a lot. And I think that what I call the globalization of urban theory came mostly through what other people have called the Southern Turn. And in terms of sort of the majority urban worlds, I don't even want to call it entry because it was always there, but the almost takeover, conceptual takeover of critical urban studies. And we must be clear that when we talk about this here in this amongst ourselves and for this podcast, we represent just the critical edge of urban studies. There is 90% of urban studies is just as mainstream and conventional as it has been for a long time. But in the worlds in which we operate, things have changed dramatically, and that was related to the Southern Turn. And one of the things, as I'm reading more and more and more, work from colleagues in the majority urban world, on the majority urban world, and there are, you know, of course, people here in this particular discussion present to do this kind of work more than I do, then I learn so much just in terms of how the language has progressed in unpredictable often and really innovative and generative ways. And for myself, and I've never made this public in outside of a smaller group. For me, I have called this thesauric urbanism. And, like in a thesaurus, you look at a word, look up a term, and then you get like 17 understandings of that term and, in the context in which you can use that term. And what Colin just said reminded me of that, is that the radical uncertainty that we feel around that is, it's not unstructured, because a thesaurus is not an unstructured mode of operation. A thesaurus actually wants to have some sort of unity of the conversation. There may be 17 ways to talk about the city or the urban, but they are still part of the thesaurus. And I think that's really important. And and there's also a radical pluralism to that, that people actually have learned to be in conversations where people have radically different understandings of what these terms mean, and we still talk to one another. And I think there were times like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when this was not the case. People stopped talking to one another and yelled at one another. But now there is an operational attempt made by all of us to start talking to one another in different ways, even though the thesauric urbanism challenges us every day to learn something new.
That's a great point. I think that leads quite nicely into the next question, which is reflecting on what we think needs to change in the way we theorize research and act in urban politics. As Roger said, people here in the conversation are a small part of urban studies, but we talk to our audience today. What do we think to grasp all these challenges, to come to terms with uncertainty, as Colin said? How far do we need to realign our ways of knowing, ways of describing theorizing and acting in relation to the urban and the political. And I'll go back to you, Julia.
I want to go back to what Colin was saying about the foreclosure of the possible, and that the right hasn't felt that, in the sense that they're the one that are actually right now creating the possible. Whereas on the left, it's kind of lagging. We're kind of lagging behind. And I think this speaks very much to what I think we need to do better. We've done it, but we need to do better at thinking together the foreclosure and the generative and transformative. That is to say, we tend in critical urban studies to focus on the crisis. And I think, at least for myself, in the last 5 years since the pandemic, I've been very, very much occupied and preoccupied in looking for responses to the crisis and looking for what I've been calling the city of reparation, the city of repair, and all of these gestures that are generating something new despite the polycrisis, right? And to think these things together means that we need to think the scales together, because of course the responses are not necessarily visible. You have to look for them. And so the scale at which you look for responses to the foreclosure and to the impossible is very micro. And so how do you think that in relationship to the full strength of these multiple structural crises that we are living through? And I think we need to find ways to do that much better than we have been doing it. This is not a new question, of course, in social sciences, thinking through the macro and the micro. But I think we really need to be creative and not to stay only on the crisis side of the analysis that we're making.
Yeah, great point. Hannah, do you want to come in there?
I totally agree to Julian with what you said. I have a project running at the moment, which is called The Responsible City, which is, of course, a term that one could criticize in a lot of ways as being about neoliberal responsabilization. But what we try to think about is what a city could be that actually could respond to these crises in ways that are maybe progressive or caring or thinking the solidary city in terms of these responses. No, I'm absolutely engaged in this project, but I think there's other dimensions we could talk about as well when you're asking how should we change the ways that we are theorizing. I'm also thinking about the collaborations in which we are theorizing. I think one of the things that a lot of people have been doing in the past 6 years, but maybe more can be done as well, is to theorize more in partnership, and that can be both in partnership cross-sectorally, no, like across activists, urban politics, but also across geographies, no, across partners in majority worlds, minority worlds, also in relation to funding. And I wanted to contextualize this also in a bit of the discussion that we had before around populism. I think the conditions in which we're theorizing today are different than 6 years ago. We're seeing today increasing attacks on critical scholarship. And that also, I guess, is a topic which links to the ways in which we theorize in collaboration, perhaps in larger projects, backed up by people that sort of also safeguard that kind of theorizing, that protect the individual theorists. No, so there's also a condition to being able to theorize in like critical and progressive ways that I think we need to be addressing.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Colin, do you want to come in there and think about what needs to be changed in terms of theory and practice in urban studies and politics?
Thanks, Ross. I would probably just echo a lot of what's been said, really. I mean, I think that there is this need to attend to the question of the possible and to the more generative connections that we can see in the city between different groups, as well as within universities, as Hannah was just saying. I was thinking a little bit about Rua Benjamin's book, the book on the imagination, A Manifesto, which is not really about cities, that book, but it's what I really like about that book is partly her kind of identification of how, you know, there's this kind of tendency to kind of in a sort of public narrative to imagine these radically different material futures through a kind of AI corporate bisterist kind of story of the future. But the notion of reinventing the social is kind of publicly portrayed as kind of a kind of hopeless, naive task. And her insistence on both the imagination as both a kind of immediate resource for tackling immediate injustices in the spaces around us, but also for defending a notion of play and speculation, thought for the sake of thought, working connections between academics and different publics in exploratory, speculative ways, and trying to do that in ways which don't necessarily always require large amounts of funding. Of course, sometimes they do, but finding little spaces where we live to make connections with different publics. And I think there's something kind of important in that kind of role for the imagination and in that sort of generative story of the possible. I would say that looking ahead, that I suspect it's an interesting question about theory as to whether we would want urban theory and urban critical knowledge of the urban political to be much more prescriptive and engaged in that sense, much more about advocating for change in collaboration with different publics, right? Rather than as Julianne was saying, locked in that kind of critique mode, which is as important as it is perhaps, the kind of orientation might then shift slightly so that we're thinking much more about generative, directive change, which would require, I don't know if the term's a more robust theory or a more proactive kind of public facing kind of theoretical intervention. I'm not entirely sure how to characterize that, but I think there's something at stake there in terms of how we think about the sort of status of theory and theoretical claims, how we generate them, who we generate them with, and how we're targeting them at change, whether it's immediate change or longer term sort of change.
Roger, do you want to come in?
Yeah, this is a complex set of issues being raised in those last contributions. In critical urban studies, we've always been criticized for not being prescriptive enough, or to, people will say to me in meetings, in community meetings, well, all you can do is criticize. And so we politically often sort of are in a corner in which we then have to define something. And, Hannah was talking about the responsible city, and Julianne about repair, reparations, and those kinds of things. And these are reactions, they're theoretical, ethical reactions also, and strategic reactions. And the work, Ross, you and I have done over the last years, we've constantly been challenged, by reviewers of our work and people we talk to. Say, can you stop talking about crisis? Can you do something, talk about the politics that comes out of it? So we constantly feel that we need to react to this. And Julianne and I are in a project in which, at the very start of this project on humanity's urban future, the first sentence of our proposal 3 years ago was about the good city. And we kind of discussed this, can we even maintain this idea of the good city in one way or another? So we have, been critically aware of the challenge that is being posed towards us. The opposite of all of that, to find a good way of finding an answer to moving out of critical mode into sort of action mode or prescriptive mode or what have you, however you want to call this, and there are different ways to call it. The opposite of that is what the tech bros and the elites of global capitalism are doing, because they are exiting the urban to create new cities or to create new places, which could be on an island or in some desert or in their mind. But in any case, while we're trying to find the good and the responsible and the repairable in cities, the ones that produce the techno-capitalist future ideas for us They want to get away from all this. They want to get away from us, and they want to get away from the city, and they want to get away from the urban in that sense that, and I just, I'm reminded when I use the word urban in this sense of getting away from the urban would be a break in the sort of epistemology that many of us have engaged with over the, you know, the years and decades, which is Henri Lefebvre's understanding of urbanization as a process that will find solutions. The urbanization is the process that what will find its own solutions to humanity's problems. That was, you know, whether you believe in that or not. And remember in his work, there is a zero and a 100 and a straight line between them. This is the idea that urbanization will solve itself and it will solve capitalism. Capitalism cannot come back from urbanization, right? So this now stands in opposition to what the most advanced sectors in capitalism want to do. They want to separate, they want to exit from that narrative, and they want to exit from that particular form of history. This is just one way of looking at it. I know there are many other ways to look at that, but that's one opposition that I've been dealing with. So when I want to look at the good city or the repairable city or the responsible city, I need to keep in mind that there are other people who are doing very evil things with some of the same language.
Just to follow up there, as Roche is linking that to politics, it occurred to me in the first round of questions, is now the urban, if we're thinking about these struggles, the tech bros, the fascists, do we now have a fundamentally different understanding of the potential of the urban as we might have done 5 years ago? Because I was thinking, you know, we called the podcast The Urban Political, and you know, that was probably resonating with that period of some kind of sense of the critical take on the urban age, the urban responses to crisis, you know, the urban revolts and uprisings, the new kind of practices we saw in cities around the world. And there's a feeling now, of course, that's kind of gone, and that the urban is, you know, is not sufficient or is diminished in that struggle. Yeah, I just want to get your thoughts on that. Julianne, you have your hand up. I see.
Yes, I wanna go back a little bit to what Roger was saying, but also taking up your question, your last question, Ross. I think it's really important to emphasize, as Roger is doing, that of course what the urban is will be very different according to who defines it, right? So the tech bros and the fascists and all of them have a specific definition of the urban, which can be contained in an image. This is a bit the point I want to make, in the sense, in an image, in a plan, in a utopia, in something that I would say from the 20th century with 21st century technologies and money to implement it and to separate, as Roger was saying. But I think alongside that, there is another definition of the urban which cannot be contained in an image, and which cannot be contained in a plan, and which cannot be captured, even going back to the question about how do we know the city. I think we need to find ways to know the city and to define the urban beyond the image, and beyond something, even beyond words. This is a very complex view of what the urban is, and it's also very powerful differently. You know, to what degree do these small resistance gestures, non-organized, completely decentralized, to what degree do all of these gestures can actually creep in this perfect plan that Silicon Valley is drawing for the urban elite, right? So I think the urban needs to be understood in relationship to what is it that we can capture as urban or not, going back to, you know, the question of the future and the possible. And whether we can capture it with words or with an image like we had done for centuries, or whether this is no longer possible, and perhaps critical urban studies should be looking for these other forms of knowing what the urban is.
Can I just add quickly to that, Ross? I just wanted to pick up on that because I think it's really important. And I think that the when we think about the kind of populist right, the way in which, for example, immigration has been politicized in our cities, and, you know, I think about Newcastle, which is a city near where I live. Recently, there was a large kind of sort of right-wing organized English nationalist march through the city centre of Newcastle. But there was also a massive and much bigger counter-demonstration showing all kinds of solidarities across different political alliances and backgrounds around the kind of idea of this sort of multicultural, hospitable city. What struck me about it was that these were both very urban kind of demonstrations. One was a kind of projection of the image of the nation onto the urban, and a kind of claiming of the urban through a political ideology. And the other was a kind of insistence that the urban is an inherently generative space of mixture, you know, that it brings together culture and difference. And so you had two different notions of what the urban was and two different renderings of its political role and potential. And I felt like that was kind of really striking about the way in which the urban becomes part of the generative production of the urban political. So I think this kind of follows on from what was being said. And it gave me a lot of kind of encouragement and heart about a kind of version of the urban, which we don't name very well, which is vital to people's sense of themselves, their identity, their politics. But I see this in different versions of this in different places. So we can talk about different kinds of urban crises. When I was doing some research in Dar es Salaam with colleagues there on looking at, for example, some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city and the impact of climate change, flooding low-income neighborhoods, destroying sanitation systems, water systems, housing complexes. But at the same time, seeing these same communities and activists organizing new kinds of water and sanitation systems to kind of like, you know, adapt to these conditions, but also to lobby the state and put pressure on the state to support different kinds of urban provisions. So you always have this kind of dialectic of these kind of political crises, and they are political, these crises. You know, it's no coincidence that these neighborhoods are located on the edges of Dar es Salaam in flood-prone areas. So it's every bit as political as the English nationalists marching down the streets in Newcastle. It's just a different kind of political manufacturing. But alongside this dialectic of crisis, you also have this kind of, you have these moments of possibility and these ways of reconstituting the urban as a political project. And you can see that even in relation to AI and the kind of tech bro images, because as much as it's anti-urban, it's also, this technology is also increasingly being used in relation to governance, policing, housing, tenant profiling as part of the kind of racial and class-based land and property markets, housing markets that we see in our cities. The AI is increasingly being enrolled in these kinds of, as lots of urban geographers have been writing in recent years. But at the same time, these technologies are being used for community organizing, digital organizing, as a way of arguing for urban co-presence, face-to-face and non-digital based kind of activism and community gathering and so on. So you always see these kind of twin processes of crisis and possibility to different extents. And I think that what I find compelling is the making of the urban in that, the kind of the generative nature of the urban and in the political. It's not just a form of politics. It's a form of politics where some notion of the urban is at stake, even if it is, as Roger was saying, a kind of thesaurus version of the urban, like lots of different kinds of urban at stake there.
I just, I'm sure there'll be some follow up on that. When you were talking, Colin, I found that really compelling, and also what you were saying, Julianne. But I was wondering at the same time, reflecting on my own work, that if this potential of the urban, this generative potential of it, is it destined or stuck in this sort of decentralizing, fragmenting type power? That it's always reactive to the state, or it's always subservient or subordinate to the state. There's almost like a hierarchy there that we sometimes sort of think about the bad guys who are kind of like imposing and the good guys who are building from the bottom. I mean, that might be the reality in lots of cases, but Is there another way in which we can think about that? Is there another image for that? There's another way of theorizing that takes us beyond that kind of, I suppose, business as a kind of hierarchical understanding. I'm not saying that you were saying that, Colin. I was saying I thought about it probably a little bit in those terms.
I wanted to talk about this in another context today, but this is a good question to make that point. I we're having this conversation, and by the time people will listen to it, we know the outcome of the event is on the day of the election of a new mayor in New York City. So there is hope that in a very dark time that a democratic socialist candidate might get elected. Soren Mamdani might get elected today. I do not want to be a hostage of fortune in this particular case, and I do hope he will win, and we will find out. But this is clearly one attempt, and a legitimate attempt to answer your question in very practical ways. If a democratic socialist can become the mayor of the most powerful city in the world, in a country which goes definitely into a different direction than democratic socialism, at a time when even thinking in these terms is disqualified by the majority of the media and by the majority of even scholarship at universities. That is a statement. And it's not a statement that is arbitrary. It is a statement about power. And it's the taking of power. And I'm reminded of the conversation I'm having with Juliana about Mexico City and what happened there over the last few years. I'm reminded of what happened in Berlin with the testing of certain ideas about property ownership of housing. I'm reminded of a whole bunch of things, even here in my own city in Toronto. So the left or the critical community activists and, everywhere in the world have not given up on actually taking power, at least in a confined space called the city of New York or the city of Toronto or the city of Berlin. People are still attempting to do that, regardless of all the other ways of decentralizing power and, creating new and innovative and important forms of political activism outside of that framework.
Do we want to follow up on Roger's comment there? If not, I think I'm going to hand over to Nitin.
Thanks a lot. I'm enjoying this conversation so much. And who better to have this 100 episode podcast conversation with than the four of you? And I was kind of just gleaning on upon what has been said so far. Many of you are involved in the project on humanities, urban future, responsible city, and all the other interesting, exciting projects. And I was wondering, the notion of urban political, which is sort of uncertain in itself, building upon your theories and ideas and knowledge, what do you reckon, where is the urban political going to be or going to look like in 5 years from now?
Yeah, I think it's a question that that follows up neatly from what we've just been discussing before. I know the kind of politics that take place in the city and the ways in which they've changed over the past years. It's a difficult question. Where are we going to be in 5 years? How can theory help us to predict this? But after all, if you think about urban processes, 5 years is perhaps also not such a long time. Now, if you issue a building permit today, your construction is going to be perhaps ready in 5 years. No, so I think there's a lot of things we can perhaps also already know, in addition to a lot of change that is predictable. No, for instance, we know climate change is not going to go away. It's just going to heighten. And we kind of know demographic change is also going to stay the same for quite some time. Useful places, useful cities are going to grow further. Older cities are going to go through migration rather than through perhaps birth rates. So migration is not going to change much, I'm predicting. I mean, here maybe we are hostage to fortune. And at the same time, I mean, we're facing cities after 50 years of neoliberalism and austerity that are sort of falling apart in their built fabric, no? So there's going to be a lot of need for reparation in these cities that are going to perhaps be as conflictive as we've seen them in the last 6 years. So I'm thinking, we've been discussing a bit how urban politics itself might change in relation to the nation state, but the kind of conflicts that I've sort of tried to map out, they are of course still going to take place in the city, you know, in the city as a site of political struggle, perhaps not only against the nation state, but really also against all sorts of like global attacks on cities, you know, global change we're seeing in economic terms, or also in geopolitical terms that are going to play out. And also, I mean, Roger just brought up this example of New York City about how cities can then still lead also in terms of progressive change. And I think we might have a lot of other examples on the table. No, it's just also thinking about Gen Z protests in Asia, Nepal, Indonesia, that are perhaps not only even directly addressing the nation state, but are really at much more global terms, taking public spaces in order to like fight out these struggles. No. And I'm not seeing such bleak times for these struggles as well, because I'm thinking about them from Zurich. When I arrived, I felt like there wasn't so much going on in terms of protests and really political organizing. I was quite quickly told off by all sorts of urban movements. And now I think there's no denying that we're seeing really active struggle against, for instance, rent evictions, against sort of very conservative mobility initiatives that we are seeing. I think we can discuss how kind of these struggles are going to change themselves, but I think the city is really going to be staying the site where all of these conflicts play out and are fought out.
Thanks, Anna. Julianne, would you like to go next?
Yes, I agree. And it can only be exacerbated, these conflicts in the way they are played out. I think also perhaps the way they will be played out, these conflicts, might change in form and format somehow. They could be either very visible or very invisible. I insist a lot on that because in Mexico City, I mean, I live in a city where the left, the populist left, is in power and has been in power for since 1997. And it's also the capital of a country where the populist left is also in power. And it's a sort of a very authoritarian type of left power. It implies whenever you have more of an authoritarian kind of politics that you would have very visible manifestations both of support and conflict. This means that the conflicts that we see in cities like Mexico City can be in the format of the protest, can be very organized by the state itself in many ways. But this doesn't preclude all sorts of other forms of generative urban politics flourishing all over the place. We just need to look for it. So going back to what Roger was saying earlier, the left hasn't abandoned wanting to seize power. I agree with that, but the left is not uniform either. And there's many, many different sorts of lefts and generative sorts of actions going on all over the place. And I think this can only be exacerbated as time progresses, because we live in a time where both the left and the right are trying to seize, capture, control the future and where we're going with different sorts of plans and interventions. And in reaction to these very ordered images of what we want for the future or the kind of response we need to put forward, you will always have quite a lot of generative, decentralized actions going on, and perhaps more and more. And even more so if, I don't think this is a 5-year time span, but what Roger was saying, you know, that some people will just abandon the cities and create all new cities altogether on the moon or wherever. What will be left behind will still be generative. I really think there is something there that we should be looking at more carefully, the different forms from which we can transform our cities, organized and unorganized.
Thanks, Julianne. Colin?
It's interesting, this conversation, because I've become slightly more optimistic as the conversation's gone on, because I think I don't know if it's just the stage of the teaching term I'm in and my general sense of exhaustion at the moment, but I was, you know, I think there's a, in the UK context, there's a growing story about the entrenchment of various forms of sort of neoliberal authoritarianism and the growth of Reform UK and the prospect of a kind of deeply right-wing populist government around the corner, which is very possible. And at the same time, all Hannah was saying about the kind of collapse of the urban public realm and disinvestment, the kind of legacy of years of austerity and neoliberalism. And you can see versions of this story writ large, of course, in many parts of the world. And it's quite, it can become a kind of colonizing discourse. And coming back to what we're saying right at the start about the way in which crisis talk can seep into our thinking, and, you know, so you have a drift from diagnosis into a sense of what becomes possible. And as this conversation's gone on, I've become more optimistic, partly because colleagues are reminding me of lots of great things that are happening in cities, however limited and sometimes unsuccessful they may be, there are always these struggles and fights going on at different scales across cities. And some of it is visible and some of it is less so. And, you know, one of the things that has been very welcome and important about the Severn Turn that Roger was talking about is partly the kind of naming and identification of all kinds of big and small P politics that go on in neighborhoods, across grassroots movements, in everyday life, across cities across the world, as well as in kind of political movements such as those in, you know, places like Berlin that we've been hearing about. So I think it's partly a question of kind of thinking about how to document, name, support, shed light on that kind of upsurge of democratic life that we find across our cities, ways of envisaging our futures, reimagining possible futures through those lessons and by documenting those different stories. I think that's probably where I would see some hope and where I would see the trajectories of research. And maybe that kind of gets us away from some of the more dystopian kind of renderings that kind of like just kind of feed through these debates that we've been having.
Thanks, Colin. Roger?
So much generative thinking here. The way I'm setting the framework in terms of kind of question you asked has been to push for the extreme possibility of thinking of the urban still as a solution, in the sense that I follow people like Warren Magnuson and also, you know, I'm very much influenced by Ross and Philip's work on local politics and Julian's work and Colin's work on fragments and all of this. I'm very much in that, in that framework of thinking without restrictions towards something that is entirely intellectually revolutionary, if not really revolutionary. So I think that's very important. But at the same time, I already made the point about New York City, is that I want to be active and I want to be responsible to the people of the city, the bounded city in which I currently live in. So I support a group like Progress Toronto here in Toronto, and they have been single-handedly responsible to get the rather progressive social democratic mayor of the city, Olivia Chow, elected. But since Olivia Chow has been elected a couple of years ago, that same organization, Progress Toronto, has been continuing to keep the pressure on the very person that that has been elected on their behalf. And so the process has to go on in the bounded concrete politics, has to constantly live in this contradiction that you always have to ask for more in very concrete terms. But the thing that really gives me grief, or, you know, at least I don't find any easy solutions, is to go beyond that bounded city and to go beyond this more theoretical idea about urban politics that I mentioned at the beginning, is the understanding, and here I put on my urban political ecology hat, the understanding that urban politics, more than it has ever been due to technological advancement, mobility and globalization, financialization, all this, urban politics, even local politics, even sub-local politics, is now defined by streams and metabolic relationships that go way beyond the boundaries of the city. And there I actually have not seen, despite me looking everywhere, I haven't seen a very good set of answers on that would allow me to think positively about how we can have a politics of the urban that is metabolic in that sense, that is so connected in that sense. How do we define a politics of the urban in a completely connected world? And that will get worse, it's not a question of good or bad, but that will get more intense as we move forward with digitization and AI and all of that. So we need to think about what kind of politics we will create beyond the urban theoretically and beyond the local practically. In that sense, where are the boundaries of our political imagination in such a connected world?
Thanks, Roger. Is there a follow-up there? If not, I just wanted to come to a close in this sort of like podcast episode. A lot of you have been guests on several of our podcast episodes, and you're, of course, listeners of the podcast as well. So I wanted to ask you, what was your favorite urban political podcast episode? What did you like about it, and why did it stick with you?
When I joined the podcast, Marcus and Ross, you had introduced it to me as really being about quick and dirty. And I think that's been the spirit that has like made the podcast so special, that you've always been able, or the podcast has been able, to quickly touch on topics that were so pertinent at the time. And one of the podcasts that for me stands out in doing this is episode 80, Spatial Planning in Israel-Palestine and the Gaza War, where Oren Yiftache and Orva Sitat are speaking about land conflict and settler colonialism in a moment where many other avenues of debate, for instance, institutional politics, don't yet allow for having these debates around. It's also an important podcast for me because you have an Israeli and a Palestinian scholar in the joint debate, and it's making quite a positive opening towards the end, which is also in a bleak moment of crisis and war, something that is so much needed. So thank you for organizing this podcast.
Thanks, Anna. Julianne?
I think my vote will go for episode 76, which was with a colleague here from Mexico, Clara Salazar, because it's in Spanish language also. I'm saying that because when we were talking earlier on about what do we need to know to, how can we change the way we do theory and create urban knowledge, I think the inter-language conversation needs to be much, much strengthened. So I really celebrated that that episode. But beyond the question of language, I think we mentioned earlier, I think it was Roger who mentioned earlier, the work of, you know, the radical work on ownership, property or ownership in Berlin. What Clara is talking about here is a very long history, a century long history of experimentation with property ownership in Mexico, and how from the Mexican Revolution on it has been changing, and what does it mean today in Mexico City, right? That these forms of communal ownership, and I think there's a lot to be learned there in terms of what's coming ahead. It's really difficult to imagine an urban future without private property nowadays. And now that the 20th century communist history is kind of dead, but I think there are a number of very radical ideas that we can think through. So I really appreciated that episode.
Thanks, Julian. Colin?
Thanks, Nitin. I think the podcast has been fantastic. I think it's one of those resources where you realize it's kind of addressing a gap that you didn't know was kind of missing, you know, and what Hannah was saying about the capacity to move quickly and to get people together to explore ideas and to engage with, you know, all kinds of questions, including topical issues, it's been a remarkable success. So, you know, just pay tribute to everyone involved, because I think it's been fantastic. I recommend it to people wherever I can. I would second a lot of the podcasts that have been mentioned. I think I've really enjoyed the talks that sort of connect ideas to public debates and public interventions, and a lot of the episodes have done that. I like the kind of lessons learned kind of element. I remember the one on Barcelona, for example, where you've got people involved who have been actively involved in local government and who are kind of reflecting on what they've learned from the process of being involved and what went well, what didn't, you know, in the kind of messy kind of world of actually entry into power in that sense. I really enjoyed the talk that, which I think was linked to the Humboldt Think and Drink by Joanna Kosiak on her book Radically Legal, which not only was very useful for me in terms of understanding more about what's happened there in Berlin, but also to introduce to some of my urban students who found it very helpful to kind of hear from Joanna, to hear from the author, rather than necessarily the just read the book. And that was obviously linked in there in the kind of podcast. And I've enjoyed the series on, is it the urban lives of property or the urban life of property? I think that Julianne was just mentioning there, that series that was kind of running across several episodes. I think it kicked off with an interview with Nick Blomley, going back a bit now. And what I think I really appreciated is not just you get to hear the insights, of course, of these thinkers who you've been reading for a long time, but you also get that sense of the personal, you know, why it is that people are drawn to the questions, these abiding questions, in Nick's case, that he's clearly been working on, you know, for decades, and to get a sense of why they matter to him, as well as to how we think about the urban political and cities. So I think that's something that the podcast does brilliantly, is it creates that kind of connection between the personal and the political in the thinkers that are involved and the reflections that they give. But those are just some examples. I mean, there's lots of great episodes. So, you know, congratulations again to you guys on making it to 100 and all the work that's happened.
Thanks, Colin. Roger?
Yeah, in the same spirit, congratulations. I couldn't believe when, you know, I was asked to be part of this, and thank you for inviting me, that you have reached 100. Unbelievable. Even more surprising if you think it's only been 6 years. So that is a huge accomplishment. I personally have used this in teaching, and the one that I would pick is one that was run, I think, in December 2020 on mobilization and advocacy in massive urbanization context. I think there were two. I used to ask a large undergraduate class of over 100 to write a reaction paper to listening to the, which is at a time when, you know, you see hesitations by students to read, to listen to something, they have no problem. And that was even more the case when the pandemic started and they were really on left to their own devices at home. Listening to a podcast like this really liberated their ideas. And this was just before AI could summarize everything and the reaction papers would be written by AI. So these are actual reactions by 20-something students on the very diverse voices that they heard from these four different cities organized, I think, by Malik at the time. So that worked really well for me. And that was a very powerful statement of the success of the medium, the success of your efforts, and amongst the crowd that you may not have imagined to listen to you, a bunch of 20-something urban studies students. So congratulations on that too. And I lastly want to just take the opportunity to thank you specifically for the podcast you did most recently. Nitin was involved on Mark Saunders' passing, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing to listen to. I dreaded listening to it. I pushed it for a few days before I actually switched it on. But when I did, I thought this was the most wonderful dedication to a kind of work which is not academic, but still radical, still theoretical, and still, you know, urban political in that sense.
Thanks, Roger. That's a very nice note to end on. Thanks. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for taking the time and thanks for listening.
We would like to close the centenary episode of Urban Political Podcast by thanking the members of our editorial collective, without whom this podcast would be impossible. We would like to thank Ross Beveridge, Marcus Kipp, Maes Jaffrey, Mathilde Lindt-Gustafsson, Leah Bonwin, Talia Blockland, Hannah Hilbrand, Anna Gosler, and myself, Nitin Bartler. Thanks for listening to this episode.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.